everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Issue by Issue Crisis. I am your host, as always, Nick Byers, and welcome. Welcome to the only show that I know of. I haven't done a lot of research, so don't quote me on that. That is going through every single tie-in issue and the entire event of Crisis on Infinite Earths before going through every issue post-Crisis of DC Comics. So welcome back, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that All Batman All the Time episode of Crisis. And I hope you're enjoying the Golden Age show. Or maybe you're not a listener of the Golden Age. Maybe you can't handle the 40s in comic book writing, which, you know, it's not for everybody. It's a tough time in comics. The story structure is lacking. But let's talk about this week's episode. We are going to be covering Vigilante number 22, the only Vigilante issue in the Crisis crossover. So we've got a little bit of information to talk about that before we get into that actual issue, because there's some backstory that we missed in the issues that we've skipped over. Crisis on Infinite Earths number 3, getting back to the main story. DC Comics Presents number 86, it's a Superman and Supergirl team up. Swamp Thing number 44, and Swamp Thing number 45. So we'll get Swamp Thing involved, which always makes everything better, because Swamp Thing is very cool. And as we've been doing the last few episodes with these tie-ins, since we're jumping all over the place, we won't be doing any sort of tying these issues to the time period when they were released, because we're all over the place. We're all over 1985 this episode, as opposed to last episode, where we're kind of going in order. So let's start with our first issue, Vigilante number 22, released July 4th, happy birthday America, 1985, with a cover date of October 1985. On the production side, we have Paul Kupperberg writing, Todd Smith penciling, Steve Mitchell inking, Timothy Harkins lettering, and Tatiana Wood coloring. So we skipped over, I believe three issues of Vigilante from the last one we covered. Oh, wait, maybe four. Let's see. Yes, so we covered Vigilante number 17 last, which was part one of Father's Day. I will say part two was in Vigilante number 18, which it ended badly for basically everybody involved, except for Vigilante, of course, and the woman that he was sort of teamed up with in that issue. Then we had Vigilante dealing with rival gangs from Chinatown, rival Asian gangs from Chinatown, and that was Vigilante's last case. Now, you might be saying, but we're three issues after that. That is correct. I should say that was Adrian Chase Vigilante's last case. At the end of Vigilante number 19, he threw away his costume and his gear. Because if you'll remember from, you know, Vigilante 16, and I think maybe he mentioned it in 17, Adrian Chase was days or weeks or a very short amount of time away from no longer being a lawyer and being a judge instead. So he decided that he could no longer make the sort of calculus that he has to do, the moral calculus in his head, to allow him to continue to be Vigilante while also being a judge. Being a lawyer is one thing. Being a judge is completely different. You are impartial. You're making sure that the law is done correctly rather than being a lawyer, which is where you're trying to win. So he said that he cannot be doing extra legal activities while he is being a judge. I get it. I do. I get it. Because I believe he was a prosecutor. So he would be, when he was Vigilante, he would be trying to send bad guys to jail. And obviously the ones that get passed, Vigilante will handle. But being judge is different. He's more of a moral arbitrator rather than someone who's just trying to win. So at the end of Vigilante number 19, he throws away his costume. There is a two-part story involving Nightwing, which is actually Nightwing's first story as Nightwing away from the Teen Titans, which is very, very interesting, I thought. And basically, at the end of, at the final panel of Vigilante 19, we see someone, not Adrian Chase, take the costume out of the garbage, because Adrian Chase is, I guess, not the smartest guy, because he just put it in a like a, one of those regular metal cylinder trash cans, just right on top. Didn't even put like other garbage on top of it. He was clearly never a picky child who had to get away with not eating something. So while, you know, because I did this back in the day, when whoever was watching me and making sure that I was eating the things that they wanted me to eat, I would take the stuff I don't want to eat, put it in the garbage, and then hide other garbage on top of it. Adrian Chase, clearly a guy who just always cleaned his plate. So he didn't know that trick. So somebody, we still don't know who, grabbed it out and had then became Vigilante. But not the same sort of level and morality of Vigilante as we've known him. Someone who works with the police and only kills when necessary, otherwise simply wounding and having people brought to justice. So this Vigilante is murderous, killing criminals just left and right. In the second part of this Nightwing story, he kills a cop and then is chased by the police. So the Vigilante, his entire reputation has been ruined. And so first Nightwing was trying to take down Vigilante, but Nightwing knows that Adrian is Vigilante. So in that two-part story, it was just basically a two-issue fight between Adrian Chase and Nightwing. Adrian Chase is not in costume, obviously. So, but he eventually convinced Nightwing that he wasn't Vigilante, because Adrian actually thought that he was in his sleep going out and continuing to be Vigilante and like killing people. So he was racked with like guilt. So he realizes that he's not Vigilante still in the end of Vigilante 21. And then Vigilante 22 is he is now starting to try to find this fake Vigilante and take him down. But it's caused a lot of problems with his relationship with Marcia, his girlfriend. And so, yeah, let's get into the issue itself of Vigilante 22. Sorry for all that preamble, but it's necessary to understand what's going on. And I will say, of the tie-ins that we've covered, this one has probably the least actual connection to Crisis. It just mentions that the skies are all weird, which, fair, Batman was also that way. But at least the fun, like the multi-part Nocturna Night Stalker storyline, or Night Slayer, I can't remember what his name was. It's been 2 weeks since I read that. She was mentioning like, oh, there's a crisis coming. And we also saw that the crisis was coming in the final panel of that story, if you remember. So those ones had a slightly more of a tie into Crisis than this one does. This one is basically not involved at all. I think the only reason it's included in these tie-ins is because the skies are all weird and storming a lot, just like in just like with Batman. But let's start, as always, with the cover. And I love what the cover artists for Vigilante often do, because Vigilante's costume obviously is majority black, with those blue and white sort of accents, chevron sort of pattern. I really love Vigilante's costume. It's so simple, and yet it's so, there's so much contrast that I just really, really love. But they do this thing often where they'll put Vigilante on an all black background, so all you can really see are his boots and his belt and his gloves and the goggles and then the lines. And but you can still see, like, your mind creates the legs and it creates the arms and stuff, and it's a very, very cool use of like negative space, if that's the correct term. So this one is no different. This one is using that technique right now, where we see Vigilante, it's obviously the fake Vigilante, because we know that, aiming his gun at us, and there's sort of circles, like the sort of target coming out from it, or just around it. And he is positioned over the silhouette of someone who was holding a gun. We see that it is a criminal later on in the actual issue, having like kind of straining in a way like he's just been shot. It's and then that is on a red background. It's just very good to look at, and I like it a lot. I'm a big fan of it. So let's get into the actual story. I'll of course post this cover, if you don't know, on our Instagram. Check it out over there. Posting stuff over there. You know, every day, pretty much every day. So it starts off with this is the first and only mention of Crisis, or maybe not only, but first of maybe two mentions of Crisis. It talks about the, I'm just going to read these captions. There is a reason for the seething hell the skies above the earth have become. The trouble is, no one seems to know what it is, for that answer lies elsewhere and concerns others. And there's an asterisk. Our concern is here on the streets of New York. Streets like others around the world, deserted by a frightened populace huddled inside, praying. Now we see the editor's note of the asterisk, and it says, the efforts of whom are chronicled in the continuing Crisis on Infinite Earths maxi-series, and then it's Marv, because I believe Marv might be the editor at this time of Vigilante. Or that's just a note from Marv, who, of course, Marv Wolfman and George Perez did Crisis on Infinite Earths. And also, I believe, created Vigilante. I may be wrong. I think one of them, at least, was involved. So, the streets are deserted, and so we see this gang of criminals. They're breaking into Biagio's jewelry store. They, you know, throw a garbage can through the window, and like there's no cops or anything out because nobody's out on the streets. So they, you know, they have no problem busting in, not being scared about being caught. When Vigilante is standing outside as they are exiting, and he tells them, you know, you're filth, you're worse than filth. And one of them pulls a gun, and Vigilante's like, I warned you. And he's not hesitant to shoot him, shoots one. Another one comes after him. He shoots the other one. And then finally, the third one is begging for mercy, and he shoots him point blank in the chest with very little remorse. He says, your kind make this world a despairing place. This is what you deserve, what justice has failed to deliver. Vigilante then makes his escape as he hears a siren of the police coming. The police come upon the scene of these three murdered jewel thieves, and we then cut away to Greenwich Village, where we are at Adrian Chase's house, which is still disheveled and broken from his fight with Nightwing, because it got crazy. Like, Marsha's apartment was also destroyed because Nightwing found him there, and his house here in Greenwich Village was just ransacked because of their fighting. And Adrian Chase is drinking to try to drink away, I guess, the pain or his issues with the fact that Vigilante, his name is Vigilante, has been ruined, and Vigilante's out there killing people, which is partially his fault because he created Vigilante. Marsha is there, and she wants answers. She wants him to talk to him, but he simply won't, because he doesn't feel that he can. Obviously, it's superhero identities, that stuff like that. He gets slightly violent and sort of swings a whiskey bottle at her, and she's like, calm down. She tells him to calm down. He gets mad at that because when anyone is in like a rage or anything, telling them to calm down never works. And he says, you know, oh, you're just whining about how bad this is for you, but like, think about how this is for me. And she slaps him in the face, and she storms out and goes, and she flees to go back to her apartment. And Adrian is still racked with the guilt of what Vigilante has been doing out there without anything. He comes to his senses and rushes out the door to try to catch Marsha, and gets her and hugs her and gives her a kiss and brings her back inside, which he does a lot. Like, she gets mad at him, and then he quickly is like, oh, don't go, I love you, all that kind of stuff. And then they kiss and they embrace, and then it's all good, and it's kind of lame. It happens multiple times this issue. This is just the first one. We then cut to the next day, even though we can't really tell because the skies are all weird, where Adrian Chase is in his new office, his judge's chambers, which we were introduced to a couple issues ago as he became judge. And he's, you know, he's just continued, like, this entire issue and these past few issues, he's just been racked with guilt and stress and all this kind of stuff because of Vigilante and because of his, you know, new job as being a judge, stuff like that. We see a headline that says Vigilante Slays 3, obviously the criminals that we saw earlier. And then Adrian is called to get up. It's time for him to sit on the bench. It's time to preside over court. And we see him go into the court, and the bailiff says, "Oh, all rise. The Superior Court of the State of New York is now in session. The Honorable Adrian Chase presiding," which is cool. We then see a apartment building in New York's Lower East Side, and we see the man who is masquerading as Vigilante, just the back of him. He's sitting in a chair at a kitchen table in a just derelict, disgusting, messy apartment in this ramshackle apartment building. And he's thinking, "Oh, I should have cleaned my gun, you know, days ago. So a dirty gun is a sign of a dirty mind or a sloppy mind. I'm not sloppy. The people need me. I'm doing good for them. It's just the media continues to lie about me." Classic words of a guy who for sure has done something wrong. Because typically, if, you know, the media is painting you in a good light because of good things that you've done, you're never like, "Oh, the media is lying about me." When it tells you the truth that you don't want to hear, that you're actually a bad guy, which this newspaper says, it says New York terrorized by Vigilante. He's like, "Oh, the media just lies. It's all fake news." And the panel pans to the side, and we see that it was actually Donald Trump as Vigilante the whole time. No, just kidding. There's no way he's in good enough shape to be Vigilante. And then this fake Vigilante dons the mask again and heads out to terrorize New York. We then cut to Adrian's house in Greenwich Village again. He has finished his workday, and he is in his basement where he stores his armaments. He didn't get rid of everything. He just got rid of the costume, which I don't know why he even got rid of the costume. Just put it away. Just pack it away. Unless he thought that with the costume still around, that he'd be tempted to put it back on and be Vigilante again. I don't know about that. You could just destroy it. I just think the main thing about throwing it away is that what if someone connects it to you? You know, what if a cop found it and they're like, "Oh my gosh, it's a Vigilante costume. Let's test it for DNA or like hair follicles or stuff." And guess what? I'm pretty sure that Adrian Chase, being a federal employee, his fingerprints may be on file. I don't know. He's federal. I believe he's a federal prosecutor, DA, district attorney. Yeah, okay. Could be state district, but I don't know. I don't know how that works. I got very distracted there. Adrian is down there getting a gun because he's going out to look for this fake Vigilante to deal with him finally, because he has been just out there terrorizing New York for 3 issues. And Adrian, this is the first time he has gotten his wits about him to be like, "Maybe I should go and do something about this." Yeah, Adrian, you're right. You should. And so he's got this gun and he's turning off the light and he's walking up the stairs, and who should come down the stairs but Marcia. And she's like, "Adrian, are you down here?" And she's like, "Oh, I'm sorry. I know it's late, but I couldn't sleep. And I thought, we have to talk about us. We have to have a relationship talk," which, like, for sure they have. They need to have that conversation because they're constantly like fighting. And one of them is storming off, typically Marcia, which is fair because Adrian refuses to talk about anything that is worrying him. Like, she found him in his judge's chambers in the fetal position. And, you know, they just kind of, once he got no longer in the fetal position, they kind of just left that. So she's like, "I think it's finally time to have this conversation." And she sees him walking up the stairs and she sees a gun in his pants. "Is that a gun in your pants, or are you just happy to see me?" It's a gun in his pants. He's very much the opposite of happy to see you. And she's, well, Adrian says, "I can explain, of course, like every person does in any misunderstanding in media." She says, "No, you can't. My lord, Adrian, what's happened to you? I don't even know you anymore." And she storms off, look, which is familiar. And so he yells after her, he yells, "Marcia," and then he And then he hits the wall and says, darn him to hell. But he doesn't say darn. I don't swear. And so I'm not going to read the swears. All right. I'm a good boy. I'm a good boy who doesn't swear. He was told at a young age, like, hey, don't swear, by his parents. And I just never have. So yeah, I'm an adult. Okay. So we then cut to the streets of New York again, where we see this family of three, mother, father, and young boy, going to the grocery store because they're out of food, which, like, that's typically when I go to the grocery store too. But it's the streets are, of course, deserted, because of the storm and the weirdness outside. And they see someone standing in front, and they go up to them, and it's a guy, and he's holding a sawed-off shotgun in his hand. And he explains that, yeah, the shipments of food have been, you know, slow. And so the Heights Warlords, which is a gang from probably could be Washington Heights. I don't know the New York boroughs well enough to make any sort of definitive statement about how many different Heights there are in New York. Washington Heights, I feel like, is one, though. I feel like that. I feel confident enough to say that that's at least one of them. They've taken over this grocery store, these warlords, and so they're sort of telling who can go in and who can't. And this family wants to go in and, you know, get some food, but the guy says no, and he points a gun at them, and they run away as instead of getting shot, which is, I think, a good decision. And they continue walking, and they walk past an alley, and inside that alley is Vigilante. And he, you know, learns about this gang taking over this grocery store. And he's like, all right, well, then I guess I'll have to deal with it. And then we see a scene where fake Vigilante, sort of systematically, sort of very John Wick. Is there someone stealthier? Maybe like a mixture between John Wick and Assassin's Creed, where he's just taking them out one by one and, like, doing a lot of it through stealth. Like, he's hiding in the back room, and then he's, you know, kind of sneaking through the aisles, and he shoots one down one aisle, and then he quickly moves, even because, I mean, like, it's a gunshot, so they're going to hear you. And they do hear him, and they go looking for him, and they find their dead compatriot, and they split up like idiots. One going down each aisle of this grocery store. One gets taken down in the meat department. One gets taken down from being shot from underneath an aisle by Vigilante down there. We again see some of this Vigilante against a black background using the use of negative space. Very, very cool. Very smart, as I've said. One gets pulled up through the drop ceiling, which, if you don't know what a drop ceiling is, it's in a lot of schools and office buildings and stuff. There's those panels, those foam panels up at the top, that's a drop ceiling, because then they can put wires and stuff up there. And so, you know, Vigilante takes one of those panels and then grabs the guy and hoists him up, and I'm assuming just like stabs him or something up there, and then shoots another one, and then finally he shoots the gun out of the final one's hands. And this entire time he's been counting, he's been saying one, you know, there's five of them left, one, two, three, four, five. And he gets to the last one, the sixth one, and he shoots the gun out of his hand. And this guy, of course, is begging for mercy. He's like, what are you going to do now? Please don't kill me. And Vigilante, fake Vigilante, I just want to make sure that we all understand that he's fake. He's a faker. He's not cool. We hate him, even though he's wearing the Vigilante costume and he looks really cool. All right. Fake Vigilante says, I'm afraid I have to, son. I wish it wasn't necessary. But I wasn't the one who turned you into a vulture which preys on his fellow man. I wish to God things could be different. And then he says, I'm sorry. He shoots him in the face, point blank. Which, okay. I don't think you need to shoot him in the face point blank. But you did do that, Vigilante. Okay. So we then cut to Adrian Chase riding his motorcycle looking cool, and he's driving through New York on his search for Vigilante. But for some reason, he ends up in the Upper West Side, which he knows for sure is not where Vigilante is patrolling. You know what? Patrolling makes it sound like he's doing good. Prowling, like a predator, which is what he is. But he ends up at the apartment building of, you guessed it, Marsha, his girlfriend, who he just yelled at, and she just yelled at him, and there's lots of yelling back and forth. And so he goes inside, goes up to whatever floor Marsha lives on, and knocks on the door. She opens it and says, who? Oh, Adrian, I. And Adrian says, please, Marsha, don't tell me to leave. We've got to talk. Yeah, Adrian, that's why she came over to your house earlier. It's now the middle of the night, even though she's not sleeping. She wasn't sleeping, because obviously she answered the door. And she says, there's nothing to talk about, Adrian. I did all I could to get through to you, but you wouldn't let me. You won't talk to me. Then the vandalism of our apartments and that gun, Adrian. I'm afraid of you. And Adrian says, then let me explain so you don't have to be afraid, Marsha. Believe me, I'm not crazy. There are explanations for everything. And Marsha says, then tell me. Tell me what they are, Adrian. And he says, I don't know that I can. And she says, then I was right. We don't have anything to talk about. Good night, Adri. And before she can finish, Adrian stops her from closing the door and he says, Marsha, wait. Sorry, I have to turn the page. And she opens the door for him and she says, I'll listen to you, Adrian, but I won't sit here and let you lie to me anymore. If there's ever going to be an us again, Adrian, you've got to tell me everything. And Adrian says, yes, I want to, Marsha. I've got to tell somebody or I'll... And she sees that he still has the gun, and so she says, that won't be coming into my apartment. And he says, that's fine. I'm not a big fan of it myself anymore. Dot, dot, dot. And so he puts it in a drawer, which is still inside of her apartment, but I guess not out in the open. And he gets close to her, and he says, God, where to begin? I think we'd better sit down, Marsha. This is going to take a while. Going to be quite a shock. It all began last year when my wife and son were killed in a bombing meant for me. I survived, but the guilt, the danger, nope, not the danger, the anger. I suppose I nearly went insane in the months that followed their deaths. So I went away, somewhere, running from my memories and my feelings. I suppose it was during that time that I first had the idea, when I realized that their killers would likely escape punishment for their crimes. I knew someday somebody had to protect the innocent and decent. So I put on a mask and a gun and stalked the streets. Dot, dot, dot. And we presume that he then tells her the story of how he became vigilante. But I would like to pause there and talk about the fact that His wife and son were killed a year ago. Or maybe not even an entire year. It just says last year. So, I mean, if we think that the timeline or like the time period is the same as in our world as it is in this fake world, this could be July. And so it could have happened in December. And he's already moved on and fallen in love? Bro, like, come on. Which I don't say that people need to, you know, be sad and mourning forever, but feels like, I don't know, feels like maybe a little more time maybe needed to pass. But maybe being vigilante was cathartic enough that he worked through his grief. And that could be. Maybe more people, especially if their loved ones are killed and murdered, need to become vigilantes, and then it would help them with their grief. I think I should be a psychologist or like a grief counselor. I'd be like, have you thought about vigilantism? Vigilantism. Vigilantism. I'm not sure. I'll look it up before I have my first meeting with someone grieving. And that's the last panel. And it says, the electrocutioner returns and the final chapter in the vigilante killer saga begins next issue. And that's Vigilante number 22. And like I said, it's the only vigilante story involved with Crisis, and it's not even involved with Crisis. It's so funny that it's included in this tie-in, sort of this entire storyline with all the tie-ins and stuff that DC Universe, and basically everywhere, says that it should be included. And I'm just like, I don't actually think it needs to be included at all. It does, like with Batman, paint the picture of like what it's like as the Crisis nears Earth One. So that is important, I would say, for context, but I don't know. Maybe. But let's move on to our next issue, which is Crisis on Infinite Earths number 3. Released March 7th, 1985, with a cover date of June 1985. On the production side, we have writer Marv Wolfman, penciler George Perez, inked by Dick Giordano, inked also by Mike DiCarlo, lettered by John Costanza, and colored by Anthony Tollin. So, as always, let's talk about the cover first. And as is often the case with these 1980s covers, it's a good one. We see the face and hands of the monitor sort of like surrounding this sphere of activity with an earth in the middle. And there's sort of like lightning, four beams of lightning, bolts of lightning coming towards it or coming out of it, whichever one you want to say. And it splits the cover up into, I think, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe? 5 or maybe 4, depending on if the monitor's face also breaks it up. I don't think so. I think it's 4 different tableaus. So it's basically the multiple teams from the monitor's like main force on their very specific missions. We see at the top, we see Brainiac 5. And I think Saturn Girl. I'm not the best well-versed at Legion of Superheroes. And they're looking at viewing screens of the activities of two teams. One person in an all-green outfit. Not sure who that is. And then another. Or it could be them looking at members of their own team dealing with the force wall and the crisis in the 34th century. That actually makes more sense, because how would they see teams? Yeah, and also it makes sense because we see members of the Legion of Superheroes. We see like Wildfire and some other ones. Like I said, I don't know the names. But we also see Firebrand and John Stewart Green Lantern and Cyborg. They're in the Old West, along with Simon with a P at the beginning. So they're gonna meet characters from the Old West like Batlash and other ones I can't remember. I can only remember Batlash because it's silly. Then we see Geo-Force and Blue Beetle in Russia during World War II, or Germany, one of the two. It's winter, and winter happens in both those countries. And Dr. Polaris is also there, and they are teaming up with the military, like the World War II characters of DC Comics, so like Sergeant Rock and the Ghost Tank and stuff like that. And then we see finally what looks to be Earth One, and not necessarily one of the teams, but the regular heroes there trying to deal with the fallout, because we see Nightwing and Jericho and Batman and some woman with wings, but it's like, I don't know who that is. And Starfire and Halo from The Outsiders. And standing in front of all of them is The Flash, Barry Allen, surrounded by this sort of weird energy, which I have to assume that you haven't read Crisis on Infinite Earths, but The Flash is very important to it, and something very, very important happens to The Flash, Barry Allen, because of it. And then finally, at the very top, underneath the 50-year anniversary of DC, 12-part maxi series, we see the Titans, the Legion, the Outsiders, and more, which would make a lot of these characters that are being involved make more sense. So let's get into the actual story, shall we? And the story begins with the monitor examining the young man now, due to his rapid aging, Alexander Luther of Earth 3. If you remember, Alexander Luther is the child of the Earth 3 versions of Luther and Lois Lane. So he is, on Earth 3 and in Universe 3, it's all flipped. So good guys are bad and bad guys are good. So Luther is the only hero of Earth 3, which that's not really how that would work, but that's how it is at this point in time. And Lois Lane is in a relationship, married and such, to him rather than Superman, which she's not at this point in time in the comics anyways. She's not married to Superman on Earth One. So, and if you remember, they shot him into, you know, through the multiverse to save him, very much an allegory or a mirroring of Superman's origin being shot away from the dying Krypton. And the monitor is examining him due to his existing in both negative and positive matter, antimatter and matter. He's both. And, it, you know, the monitor is very cryptic. He feels really bad because, you know, someone has to be the key to stopping this crisis, and he thinks that Alexander Luther is that key. And unfortunately, that means that he'll eventually have to die. It's very sad, or corrupted, I guess. Maybe not die, but corrupted. Harbinger then asks the monitor if he needs her help, and he says, or he doesn't say anything. He just ignores her, because, I mean, he's contemplating things. But in reality, he already knows what's going to happen. Spoiler alert. So Harbinger flies off and teleports to the antimatter, or to the antimonitor's own spaceship, which is all, it's very dark in there, because we have yet to see the antimonitor in the flesh, or like without just being a silhouette. Because if you remember, Harbinger was corrupted. When she split apart, she was corrupted by antimatter, you know, badness. So she is a pawn to the anti-monitor, and then her and Psycho Pirate, who you'll remember was taken, or not taken, but has joined the forces of the anti-monitor, they have this conversation where the Psycho Pirate is annoying, and the anti-monitor tells him to shut up, and he instructs Harbinger that it's time for her to do her duty. She's got to destroy the Luther child so that he's no longer a threat. And she'll have to do whatever she needs to do in order to make that happen, which is bad. We then see a little story of the Flash, who is in the future of Earth One, which is a storyline that happens at the end of his series in Flash number 350. I'll summarize it for you. Iris West Allen. It was discovered that she is actually from the future, and she was sent back in time to protect her or something like that by her parents. And so she finds out she's from the future. So after the trial of the Flash, her and Barry go to the future to live out their lives and be happy, which superheroes rarely get that sort of happy ending. So it's very nice. But the future is not doing so hot. I'll say that, nor is any time period in Earth One, as we know. It's all being destroyed simultaneously across the timeline by antimatter. And the Flash is running around. He's just seeing the destruction that's happening from all this storm and this weather and these earthquakes and all these kinds of things. When in the future, they've stopped these things from being destructive. There's devices and things to stop earthquakes or mitigate earthquakes and all this kind of stuff. But then he sees the white wall of antimatter coming for him and, you know, the Earth, not just him. And he says he's got one chance. And so he starts vibrating, and then he fades away. And then we cut to July 1985 on Earth One, where we see the Outsiders and the Teen Titans kind of in New York City, or Gotham, it doesn't say, or Metropolis, it doesn't say. They're in a metropolitan area, and they are also seeing this white antimatter force, and they're trying to, you know, save people. All these buildings are crumbling, and the people are getting hurt and dying, and then obviously getting deleted from existence. And we do meet for the first time Cole, who is a hero who was introduced in Teen Titans number 9. Oh, sorry, The New Teen Titans number 9, because I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but the Teen Titans titling and numbering and stuff like that is all very, very confusing. because there is an issue of Teen Titans in these tie-ins that is talking, that is Teen Titans number 13, but it's the Teen Titans 13 from the original run of Teen Titans. So if you were to not realize that, you'd just suddenly be reading a story about the Teen Titans teaming up with the Doom Patrol and having no mention of Crisis at all. So Cole is Cole Weathers. She is a hero who can fly and manipulate crystals and stuff like that. It's not important. She's in, you know, two pages. But she will probably, I believe she is in a little bit more of Crisis Infinite Earths. And then I guess we'll find out if she is in the Teen Titans going forward as post-Crisis timeline begins. So, you know, we see all the members of the Teen Titans, Starfire, Wonder Girl, Nightwing, Jericho, Cole, not Cyborg. He's not there. He is with the Monitor's, you know, Crisis Squad, and Beast Boy. And then we also see the Outsiders. We see Metamorpho, Katana, Black Lightning, Halo, not Geoforce, because he's also on the Monitor's Crisis Squad, and Batman, and then... So there's this few pages where they are stopping, they're bantering, of course, and then they're stopping buildings from crumbling, and they're getting people down to ground level, even though, you know, like, what's the point of that? And then Batman and Superman show up, and they're saying, like, you know, there's nothing we can do. We, you know, this is some sort of thing that is outside of our, you know, what is that called? Outside my pay grade. That's it. Even though Superman is one of the most powerful. But, I mean, the Monitor is way more powerful than Superman. When suddenly the Flash appears. And if you remember, the Flash appeared previously in, I believe, Crisis on Infinite Earths number one, in the same kind of way to Batman when he was dealing with the Joker that was referenced at the end of the Batman arc that we just read last episode. And he's glowing, and he's you know, done stuff with vibrations and stuff, and he's got to tell people, and Batman goes to try to, you know, grab him so that, you know, he can like sort of anchor him here so he doesn't disappear again. But Jericho, for whatever reason, can sense that that's a bad idea, so he kind of tackles Batman, stopping him from touching the Flash in this weird energy that he is surrounded by. And then the Flash, sort of in five panels that are a little gruesome. I may post them if I remember. He sort of like phases out, like he turns to static basically and disappears. And everyone's shocked. There's all these shocked faces. We then get a scene of Brainiac on his Brainiac ship, which I will say, just great design. I love Brainiac's ship. Every time I see it, it's like just a big head with tentacles. It's very cool. It's very Cthulhu-like, even though Brainiac is a, you know, super smart robot android thing. And Brainiac realizes what is happening. And so he flees away from this antimatter force and heads towards Earth, realizing that only one person can help him. And that is the person who calls himself Luthor. So Lex Luthor of Earth 1 is the only person that can help Brainiac to stop this crisis, because Brainiac wants to live and take over the universe, but if there's no universe around, what is he going to take over? We then cut to spring 1944 in Markovia during World War II, where we see the armed forces characters of DC Comics, so Sergeant Rock and Easy Company, the Losers, the Haunted Tank, which the Losers are a group of, I guess, screw-up military men who, you know, go on adventures and save the day. There's a movie from, like, 2007? Is that right? The early aughts, or, like, the aughts, sometime in the aughts, with, I mean, pretty good cast. I have never seen it all the way through. I've seen parts of it. I mean, it's probably just, it feels like just a standard action film. And then the Haunted Tank is a tank unit that the people on board can talk to the ghost of this tank. They do fly a Confederate flag because the head is Jeb Stuart, and he is a Southerner, which, I mean, come on. We don't need to do this. I know it's 1985, and people are, like, not are still like, oh yeah, heritage over hate or whatever, but like, come on, you gotta know. It's like states' rights to what? You know? States' rights to own people. So there's destruction happening, but just regular military destruction. Nazis blowing stuff up and hurting civilians of Markovia. And the squad that has been tasked with defending the positive matter tuning fork thing that is here in Markovia in 1944 is Blue Beetle, Geoforce, and Polaris. And which is, I mean, not a bad spread, because Geoforce and Polaris are both very powerful, and Blue Beetle is very smart and has gadgets and such. And they, you know, they fight Nazis, they kill some Nazis, it's very fun. And then suddenly the shadows come out, and members of the Losers are, you know, disintegrated, and members of Easy Company are disintegrated. But not all of them, just some of them, and they fight against them, and eventually the shadows are dissipated, just like they always are. Geoforce and Polaris deal with them, and there's this scene at the end where Blue Beetle is on the tuning fork, and he's kind of crawling around. I don't know why he's doing that, but he's crawling around on the tuning fork when a shadow grabs him, but his blue scarab, which he doesn't have any powers from, because Blue Beetle is the second Blue Beetle. Dan Garrett is the first one, and he had powers due to the forces, like the mystical powers of this blue scarab. Later on, Jaime Reyes will get powers, a sort of powers like a mechanical suit from this blue scarab when it's discovered that it is an alien technology rather than ancient mystical technology or magic. And the scarab sort of explodes the shadows. But eventually Blue Beetle is too injured, and he falls off of the tuning fork, and the monitor says, despite his lack of powers, I was hoping the Blue Beetle scarab could aid in my mission here. Unfortunately, that was not the case. His assistance is no longer required. Thus, I shall return him and the other wounded one to their own time. So Blue Beetle gets sent back to whatever Earth he is from. I don't remember if it gets a designation. It's the Charlton Comics universe, which were, you know, acquired by DC and then later folded into the multiverse and the DC universe as a whole. After post-crisis, we then get a scene with the other crisis squad that we've met previously, with Dawnstar and Superman, Earth 2 Superman and Solovar, who have been who we saw, you know, dealing with or aiding Kamandi, the last boy on Earth, in the future or like mid-future of Earth, I believe Earth 1. I'm not sure if it designated which Earth it was on. And we see this very touching scene where Solovar, who is a talking animal, a talking ape from Gorilla City, or I should say a talking gorilla from Gorilla City. And it's a very touching moment, at least I think so, because Kamandi lives on a world where animals have become sentient and they do human activities and they, you know, have destroyed the human race, and Kamandi being the last boy left. And so it's a very touching moment where he feels sadness as Solovar, who has been injured by the shadows, dies, or doesn't die. He's getting close to death, but then he is teleported back. He's the wounded one that the monitor was talking about, Solovar. And Kamandi's very sad about that, and I think that's really touching. It really shows that, you know, Kamandi realizes, hey, not all talking animals are bad. We then cut to the town of Coyote, Texas in the year 1879, presumably on Earth 1. I'm presuming it's Earth 1 unless it's stated otherwise, where we meet Batlash, who is a cowboy character from the time when DC was very into Westerns, as most comic companies did at one point in time. He's kicked out of Coyote, Texas because he was flirting with the bar or hotel owner's daughter, and we learn here that Batlash is a very, you know, ladies man kind of character, and he reveals that he has been called here by Scalp Hunter, who is a that's a terrible name, but Kiwo Note, who's a Native American character from DC Comics' Western, who has the designation Scalp Hunter, which, yeah, we'll just leave that because it's problematic. They don't actually use that name here at all, except for maybe in passing. Let's see, I thought he said something. Oh, yeah, he said half-breed Scalp Hunter. Which, like, yeah, just casual racism. It's 1879. There was tons of racism back then. So, I mean, I guess they're being realistic, but I don't know. And then we meet the rest of the Western heroes that Kiwa Note has called here to this crisis tuning fork, or positive matter tuning fork, that has been placed here in 1879 in the West. We meet Kiwa Note, we meet Nighthawk, we meet Jonah Hex, which we've met previously in the show, and then we also meet Johnny Thunder, but not the Johnny Thunder you're thinking of. And they're kind of huddling around this tuning fork, being like, what is it? Like, what do we do about it? And they're like, I'm not sure, but we've got to get some weapons, just in case. That's when... another one of the Crisis Squads shows up. We've got Simon with a P at the beginning, Green Lantern, John Stewart, Cyborg, and Firebrand. And at first, the cowboys are like, ah, what are you? Shoots them. But, I mean, they stop and explain themselves. Jonah Hex reveals that Green Lantern has been here before, a Green Lantern. It says, don't you remember the green costume on that hombre? It's the same one we saw on another guy who called himself a lantern or something. They do mention that this lantern is black, and John Stewart says, oh, I replaced the other lantern, which is true. They're kind of talking, and they're saying, oh, we're from another time, all this kind of stuff. When shadows attack, and they're fighting, Simon tries to use his psionics, and it doesn't work. The cowboys try to use their guns, it doesn't work. Firebrand uses fire, it blasts them apart. Cyborg uses white sound. Which I would just assume is the sound of the suburbs, I guess. And John Stewart attempts to use his power ring, but for whatever reason, it's not working, even though he says it has a half day's charge, which is a sufficient amount of energy to do stuff. Jonah Hex saves Green Lantern from getting hit by a shadow. And suddenly there's this high-pitched whine, and the cave starts caving in. And Nighthawk, who is he's the only cowboy wearing a mask, and he's wearing like a black shirt and a white bird on there, which I think is pretty cool. Pretty cool look. And he starts riding away on his horse, saying everything's going crazy. It's got to be the metal machine's fault. Never did trust mechanical things. And he's riding back to Coyote when he sees the white antimatter force wall enveloping Coyote, Texas, all the people, all the animals, all the buildings, and his horse bucks him off and he falls to the ground, and then Nighthawk is enveloped by the antimatter force and is disappeared. We then cut to Metropolis in the 30th century. This is where the Legion of Superheroes comes in. We see four members of the Legion of Superheroes who I'm not going to attempt to identify because I'm going to get them wrong. I only know Wildfire because he's the one who wears like the suit to contain himself because he's some sort of alien or something. And we see Brainiac 5 and Dream Girl. I was wrong. It's not Saturn Girl. It was Dream Girl in the sort of command center being like, oh no, what's happening? Like, they can't do anything. And Dream Girl's like, why didn't I dream of this coming? How did this happen without my knowing about it? Brainiac 5 then attempts to contact another member who's out doing patrolling stuff. Kid Psycho, who is a Hajorian. He's the last member of the Hajorian race. And he has psychic abilities, telekinesis, stuff like that. And he is out there. And he's not answering. And we see Mon-El and Element Lad, who are saving people. Mon-El is carrying a big thing with a bunch of people on it, saving them from the antimatter force field, or force wall. And Kid Psycho, we see, gets knocked down by a crumbling building, and he is still on the ground as he is also enveloped by the antimatter force wall. And unfortunately for Kid Psycho, That is his death. Oh, poor Kid Psycho. We barely knew ye. It's almost like I had to look you up because I'd never heard of you before. Because I will say, even though, as I've said previously, I'm not a big Legion of Superheroes guy, I know some of them, right? But I had never heard of Kid Psycho, which is fair. He was only around for 20 years. And I didn't... Now, that sounds like a long time, but I'm not... I wasn't alive then. I wasn't alive from 1965 to June 1985 in Crisis on Infinite Earths number 3 when he dies. We then see the final page where there's different screens in the monitor satellite where we see the antimatter force wall enveloping ancient Atlantis, the Old West, the 30th century, the present of Earth 1. And I'm just going to read verbatim what happens on this last page. The monitor says, "He's moved quicker than I expected. Instead of days, only hours remain. The Earths are doomed. Still, my machines are in place. My agents are at their posts. It is time for my plan to begin." Then someone from behind him says, "Wrong, old fool. It is time for you to die." And we see that it's Harbinger, and she's got black eyes, and she's powering up her whatever her hand blasts do. She's ready to kill the monitor. And we see next issue. This is the big one. The end of the multiverse. When worlds die. That's the end. It's the end of Crisis on Infinite Earths number 3. Poor monitor. He's gonna die. Sad. Sad day. Sad day for him. But let's move on to our next issue, which is DC Comics Presents number 86, which, as I said, is a team up between Superman and Supergirl. It was released July 4th, 1985, just like Vigilante 22. Cover date October 1985. And on the production side, it was written by Paul Kupperberg, penciled by Rick Hoberg, inked by David Hunt, lettered by Gaspar Saladino, colored by Eugene D'Angelo. So, let's talk about the cover. The cover is good. It's good. I like it a lot. It has Superman and Supergirl in her headband era costume, where she does have a red headband. Still a very short skirt, which, all right. And Supergirl and Superman are punching each other, fighting each other, which I will say doesn't happen in this comic, if I'm remembering correctly. Maybe I'm forgetting that they do fight for a time, but I don't believe they fight. And behind them is a woman who is wearing, or maybe not wearing, maybe that's just the way her body looks. It looks like she's wearing a full, like, spandex costume that has, like, cosmic-y stuff on it, and, like, a dark cape cloak situation, and she's got energy coming out of her hands. This is Black Star with two R's at the end to make it super, I guess, or evil. I don't know. More R's is more evil. I don't know. But it says Black Star spells blackout for the Kryptonian Crusaders, which is a lot of good alliteration. And we, of course, have the special Crisis crossover banner at the top, which indicates that this one, tangentially, is related to Crisis on Infinite Earths. So, it begins by talking about a bunch of cosmic-y stuff happening, referencing the Crisis, and how the universe is kind of going insane because of it. And it mentions these twin black holes that are, like, next to each other, which is not what black holes do, because eventually one gains a more powerful gravitational pull and would suck the other one in, spaghettifying it, which I believe is what happens when things get sucked into black holes. Otherwise, it's just a fun word that I've heard. I'm like, oh, spaghettification. The astrophysicists out there can correct me if I'm wrong. We then cut to Supergirl, who is flying through the streets of Chicago? Chicago. Doesn't really say, but if we were reading Supergirl at the time, we would know that she's in Chicago, I believe. And it's very weird because she is she's flying through, like, the skies are all dark and weird, and there is, like, the big white antimatter force wall just in the background, which makes me think that this is a lot more urgent, but, I mean, it's kind of, everyone's kind of just at a standstill. She stops some hoodlums who are driving a car recklessly that they have stolen, and they're about to hit, like, she stands in their way, and they turn to, you know, avoid her, and they almost hit a building, but she picks them up and brings them up into the sky, which is what superheroes do. We then cut to Metropolis at WGN. I think it's WGN. WGBS? I'm not sure. One of the, whatever the Daily Planet has been bought under, and is the now news station that it's under. And Perry White and Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen and Clark Kent are in Perry White's office kind of having a meeting talking about the weird stuff that's happening with this crisis. Everyone calls it a crisis, which it is, but I think that's just a good shorthand way for characters to reference the event without actually referencing the event, because they don't necessarily know about the event and the stuff that's going on in the background. But crisis is, I think, a normal enough word that it would be okay for it to come up in casual conversation without it being like, oh, why do they know that's what it's called sort of thing. And Clark Kent is distracted because he's just standing here or sitting here. He's like doing that sort of half sit that people do. I also like to do it on desks and stuff where you're kind of sitting, but you're kind of standing. And he's just using his supervision to just stare off into the distance at this antimatter force wall that is coming for them. Which brings me to a point. After reading this, I would really like to make my own order for these tie-ins, because I would put this one before the previous Crisis on Infinite Earths issue that we just covered. I'd put it before 3, because in 3, the force wall is kind of closing in on the people of Earth 1, right? And in the present, because, like, we see, you know, that scene that Superman is there with the Teen Titans and the Outsiders, where the force wall is, like, coming for everybody. It's very close by. So I think that this idea that he's just, like, staring into the heavens with his supervision to watch this force wall is just kind of, I don't know, out of order. So I would put this one before number 3. Similar to with the Batman storyline, which I would put before maybe even number 1. There's a reason why those Batman issues didn't have a Crisis banner on them. I don't know if I mentioned that, but you probably can see on our Instagram that they don't have the Crisis crossover tie-in banner across them. None of the issues do, which makes it seem, well, it doesn't make it seem, it is, which we learn, it's before the Crisis even begins. It's before number 1, which is me being nitpicky about continuity across different comic books, which it's if you get into that sort of mindset, you will go insane, which I often do trying to parse things in my mind about how things can start when other things haven't started yet, even though an issue comes after such and such. So one of the things that Clark sees while looking into the heavens with his supervision are these double black holes, these twin black holes in the Renial V sector. I should, as I've said, double black holes or twin black holes are not natural. So something's causing them, because otherwise one would consume the other. Clark makes a quick exit and becomes Superman. Of course, his coworkers are all like, that Clark Kent, he's out to, you know, get the story about this crisis. You know, he's out there doing that stuff, and they kind of wonder, like, oh, I always wonder how he gets the scoop, and how he gets the scoop is he's Superman. We then see, we're back in Chicago, and we're in the apartment of, what is her name in this? Linda Danvers, because at this time, in this pre-crisis story or universe, Supergirl's secret identity is Linda Danvers. And Linda Danvers gets a call from Barbara Gordon, who wants to meet her on top of a building. And, of course, they know each other's secret identities. Barbara Gordon knows that Linda Danvers is Supergirl, and vice versa, that Barbara Gordon is Batgirl. So they both rush to this specific place, and they talk about this oncoming crisis and how it kind of feels like they're stuck and that death is, you know, coming for them. It's really like nothing that they can do. When Supergirl has to save an airplane who's been struck by lightning, by the weird, you know, weather that's happening, and Batgirl is watching her and is just like kind of really proud of Supergirl for just throwing herself into danger even at this time. And before Supergirl can get back to Batgirl, Superman finds her and tells her about the Reniel V sector twin black holes. So they rush out there into space and eventually get to these twin black holes and are investigating them when something starts to happen. Energy from the black holes is being very weird. They're not sucking in energy, they're releasing energy, which of course they shouldn't be able to do because black holes don't do that. It should be sucking all energy and matter in, not expelling it. And they notice that the energy is escaping towards the center, to a center spot between the black holes, rather than dissipating or, you know, shooting out in all directions. When suddenly the twin black holes sort of explode or implode or combine or do some sort of cosmic stuff, and out comes a woman, the woman we see on the cover, Black Star, and she's, you know, she says Black Star is free and she will have her vengeance against the one responsible for her cruel imprisonment, which, spoiler alert, is Supergirl. Now, this part is stupid, all right? I'm going to say that right now before I even tell you what it is. It's dumb. So I'm going to just verbatim. Here we go. This basically this entire page because it's... Well, you know what? I don't need to do verbatim. I'll just tell you. Supergirl fought Black Star before, previously. It is... Black's not it. Her, she, Black Star, is actually named Rachel Berkowitz, and she is Supergirl, Linda Danvers, landlady's daughter. They were in Poland. They were separated in Poland during World War II and were separate. Did I say separated? They were separated. And Rachel somehow survived and made it to America, just like her mother. She was getting PhDs. She was stacking up PhDs like firewood by the time she was 21. She then discovered or unlocked the secret to Einstein's unified field theory. So her understanding of the universe gave her absolute control over all aspects of the cosmos. And then Supergirl says, to defeat her, I maneuvered her between twin black holes just like these. That explains their presence now. Now, Supergirl, don't you think you should have mentioned that when Superman said, hey, we're going to go investigate these twin black holes in the Reniel V sector. Just for your reference, this whole storyline took place in Supergirl number 13 through 15, which came out in August of 1983. So it's been a couple years, so maybe she forgot. I just don't typically think that I would ever forget maneuvering someone in between twin black holes, which don't naturally exist in the universe. But Supergirl and these heroes, they deal with a lot of weird stuff. So maybe they have so much room in their brain for all the weird stuff they do. So I'll cut her some slack. It's been a couple of years. Black Star then realizes, ah, Supergirl is here. I get exactly what I want because I control the universe. All yada, yada, yada. Evil person stuff. She then bombards Supergirl with quasars, which are a physics thing that I don't understand. I have an arts degree. A history arts degree, I should mention, not like a fine arts degree. I have I guess what would history be considered? I mean, it's an art. It's under the arts in colleges and universities. Although I don't consider it an art, I consider it a sort of science, a social science, if you will. Although that's not correct either. But enough about that. I don't know what quasars are, okay? I'm not a scientist. I'm not a STEM major person. Or I wasn't. I'm not in college anymore. So, seeing this, Superman rushes at Black Star trying to get the jump on her, coming from behind. But, unfortunately for Superman, Black Star has the powers of, like, controls all of, like, it's a very weird. She controls all of space and time or whatever because she can, she knows the unified theory, the secret of the unified theory. But I don't understand how that works. Like, oh, I just understand how it works. I think about it, and I don't. I'd have to go back and read those Supergirl issues, which I'm not going to do, for this one-off. Probably this is probably the last time she ever appears, villain. I could be wrong, of course. So, you know, Black Star says, "Fool! Nobody comes upon Black Star without her knowledge," and she shoots Superman away with the forces of a million gravities, which. Okay. And then she captures Supergirl in the sort of similar way that Supergirl captured her. So instead of putting her in between two gigantic black holes, she sort of does the drawing and quartering sort of thing, position that they did back in the day when they used to draw and quarter people. So there's four tinier black holes that are basically pulling on all four of Superman's limbs, making her do like an X shape, like Vitruvian Man sort of shape, although without the extra arms and legs. And so she's like, ah, yes, I've won. And Supergirl's like, stop what you're doing to the universe. And Black Star's like, well, I'm not doing anything to the universe. What are you talking about? And she looks around and she's like, oh my God, has the universe gone mad? And Supergirl is, you know, says there's something wrong, and it's maybe a side effect of like what you did to escape. And Black Star's like, you dumb idiot, why would I want to destroy the universe? I want to control the universe, and without a universe, I have nothing. It's very similar to Brainiac's sort of logic in trying to stop the crisis. He's like, without a universe to rule over, I'll have no universe to rule over, and it'll be a bummer. Black Star then, for some reason, seems to think that Superman is the cause of this, you know, disturbance in the universe. So she's going to, you know, destroy Superman. And so Supergirl, having distracted Black Star enough to have her stop her black hole drawing and quartering, rushes to Superman. To sort of save him and, you know, talk to him. And she's trying to convince him to leave, like, to get away, because Black Star thinks that he is the problem. And Supergirl says, well, we need to, like, work with her or stop fighting against her for the good of the universe. And Superman says no and, you know, rushes at Black Star. Black Star then blasts him with some cosmic powers, but he's like, I'm not afraid. And then here comes the part where they do fight Supergirl and Superman. Supergirl rushes at Superman, punches him in the face. And Superman, you know, doesn't like that. And he blasts her with his eye, with his laser. What are they called? Laser eyes? Heat vision. Sorry, laser eyes. I'm stupid. He's not Cyclops. And then he you know, goes back to trying to fight Black Star. But then Black Star warps him into a different reality, like through this portal. She does this kind of very cool thing first. So she sort of freezes, or not freezes. It's very confusing. So she takes Superman's perspective and continues to make him think that he's flying very, very fast towards her. But in reality, he's standing still. And then she puts a black hole in his path. And then releases him. So even though he's been sitting here sort of paused in relative time, but in his mind, he's been flying like light speed forward. And so he flies through this black hole, and Supergirl, chasing after him, flies in as well, and they are put into a different, like, universe, plane of existence, it alternate reality, whatever you want to call it. It's all crazy in there. It's really crazy in there. And basically, they don't explain how. Well, I guess they do explain how, but it doesn't make any sense. The momentum of Supergirl tackling Superman, who is also moving very fast, they bust through the other side of that reality back to basically exactly where they went through, which I don't think that that's how anything works. Having done something that's seemingly impossible, Black Star is shaken. Like, how did you get back here? That doesn't really make any sense. And Superman then, as a way to convince Black Star that he's not the problem or that they need to fix this, I'm going to be honest, the story is not coherent or good. Superman explains that he just flew by that star that was millions of light years away. It's gone Nova, supernova. And so Black Star, being really smart, she's like, oh, that can only mean one thing. That can only mean that the star has moved closer, because there's no way we would have seen the explosion if it was fine last week, because it takes light years for the light to reach them. It's okay. So realizing this, Black Star's like, oh, the universe is shrinking. That's what's happening. It's not, but whatever. So they come up with a plan where Black Star is going to imbue them with, like, they're going to link Superman and Supergirl together with this cosmic energy bond, and they're going to fly to the edge of the universe to reverse the shrinkage. And we see that, you know, Black Star is straining to maintain the bond, and the super people are flying in their opposite directions. And then they finally reach the end of the universe, and kind of thing happens, and it's reversed. And even though it's not, it's, this whole story is pointless because it doesn't make any sense. Superman and Supergirl fly back to where they left Black Star, but she has disappeared, even though they were both keeping an eye on her with their supervision the entire time. But she just vanished. Was she destroyed from what they just did, or did she disappear on her own? Who knows? But they're happy because they solved the mystery. So now they're back to square one. And Supergirl flies off after being asked by Superman if she wants to head to his place to talk about, you know, what's going on. She says, no, thanks. I can't sit still just now. I still feel edgy. Can't shake this ominous feeling. And we see at the caption at the bottom of the final page that it says, the reason behind Supergirl's morbid feeling becomes deathly clear in the October Crisis on Infinite Earths, on sale now. Which, obviously, you know, and I know, that we have not reached the October Crisis on Infinite Earths. And when they say October, they mean cover date of October, which would mean the one that was released, I guess, 3 months prior. So, like, the July Crisis on Infinite Earths. Because we've only reached the March/June cover date Crisis on Infinite Earths. Cover dates and actual release dates are so stupid. I hate them. They make it so confusing. So, yeah. So, something's going to happen to Supergirl, but we're not going to figure that out until a while, because we have to get all the way through. It's probably, let's see, Crisis on Infinite Earths number 4 is April, May, June, July. Probably Crisis on Infinite Earths number 7. So we're a ways away from that. So that was DC Comics Presents number 86, and it was a mess. It was a mess. You know what? Paul Kupferberg does a lot of good writing, but that one felt like he didn't really have a lot to work with in terms of story. And I don't know if that's because he had to tie it into the crisis or because he just wrote a bad story. We'll never know. Or maybe we will. Is he still alive? Let's look. Let's do a quick Google. I'm going to quick copy the name Paul Kupferberg, paste it into the Google search bar, and find out that he is alive and he's only 68 years old. He could remember this story and be like, yeah, I just kind of phoned it in that time. Just kind of phoned that one in. Which we all do sometimes, Paul. It's okay. But let's move on to our final two stories, Swamp Thing number 44 and Swamp Thing number 45. These are stories or comics or issues, whatever you want to call them, that are similar to a lot of the ones that we've been reading. Don't really tie into the crisis in any real way other than just mentioning the crisis. But I will say that these two issues build up to an issue of Swamp Thing, Swamp Thing number 46, that actually is a legitimate tie-in to Crisis on Infinite Earths. But the story, the main story of these comics, completely nothing to do with it. There's just specific details at the end of each issue that are important. But before I get to that, because I'm not going to recap all these stories because they're pointless to Crisis. No offense. Sorry about that. It's just that this is the second time that I've had to record this. And so I'm sorry. So I should fill you in on what Swamp Thing's been up to since we last saw him. We last saw him in the first part of a two-part story, very similar to Vigilante, where he was dealing with a man who radiated nuclear radiation because of him drinking contaminated water. Nuke Face was his name. And basically in the second part of that story, Swamp Thing is basically destroyed. So in the issue after that, he is being regrown slowly by Abby Arcane, but right now her name's Abby Cable. That's a whole another thing. But we also get in issue number 37 the introduction of a very important character to Swamp Thing's continued furthering mythos and, I would say, the mystical side of the DC universe. And a real fan favorite. A lot of people like this guy. And that is John Constantine, the British magician, mage, whatever you want to call him, who's always wearing a trench coat and a red tie, smoking cigarettes, swearing, drinking, being a real bastard. That John Constantine debuted for the first time in Swamp Thing number 37. So, this then begins a sort of overarching storyline in Swamp Thing that doesn't really have to do with the actual stories of the issues, but more is moving towards something, a bigger story that will conclude. So Constantine sends Swamp Thing, or not sends him, but like says he should be in certain places at certain times in order to deal with things, bad things that are happening. He sends him to Rosewood, Illinois, and then up to Maine, and then to Louisiana, which is where we get this first issue, Swamp Thing number 44. He's dealing with a serial killer called the Boogeyman. And at the end of this issue, Constantine sends him, or he calls Abby Arcane at her house and tells her to let Swamp Thing know to be in San Miguel, California a week from today. And tell him it's the last stop before the finale. That's all. That's all you get. You can get back to, you know, reading your book and going to sleep. Because it's nighttime. So that's 44. 45 has Swamp Thing going to San Miguel, California. And dealing with this haunted house and these people inside of it. But the really important part is the basically, not final two pages, but final, like the third to, sorry, I'm trying to figure out, so not the last page, but the second to last and the third to the last page of this issue are the ones that matter. Swamp Thing, having dealt with this haunted house, is walking through the swamp and finds John Constantine standing there. I guess it's not a swamp, it's San Miguel, through the forest, and finds John Constantine smoking a cigarette, and I'm just going to read these two pages verbatim. John Constantine lighting a cigarette says, "You came then. Got the message I left with your girlfriend, eh?" Swamp Thing says, "Yes. I came as you requested. I am no longer certain why. I know that you will only give me another riddle, another enigma, another senseless destination, never the truth. And John Constantine says, the truth is that I'm not going to do a British accent because I can't. I can't do it, Gov. Love, I can't do a British accent. I can kind of do a British accent. The truth is that all. Well, why didn't you say? Lads, he wants the truth. Come on and say hello. Come on, he won't bite you. It's not terrible. It's not great. It's not terrible. And out come these two guys. And the nerdy one wearing glasses says, this is it. It's like one of the spawn of Shub-Niggurath. Ooh, I realize that that has a slur in it. I mean, it's Lovecraft. That Lovecraft mentioned. That makes that wow. Okay. Hey, Constantine. This is the other one. Sorry. This is the one who's wearing a biker hat and sunglasses. And he says, hey, Constantine, this is pretty intense, you know? I mean, geez. Swamp Thing says, Constantine, who? And Constantine says, this is Benjamin Cox. And this is Frank North. This accent is just indecipherable. They're associates of mine. They'll be helping us with these final stages. Swamp Thing says, final stages? And John Constantine says, that's right. There should be others, but our operative in London lost touch, so Sister Anne Marie's gone to find her. And one of them, it's not the biker one. He doesn't actually get a legit, like they don't identify which one is which. He says, hey, John, it's getting late, man. We better get going. And Swamp Thing says, going where? And Constantine says, where are we going? Where are we going? You know, you're worse than a bloody kid on a day trip to bloody Skegness. We are going to show you this truth that you're so keen on. See, as it happens, I've got a couple of front row tickets for the end of the universe. I thought it'd be best to use them now. I mean, you never know. There may not be a second performance. So that may be really confusing, but here's the thing. It's confusing even if you've read the issues, you know, leading up to this. Because John Constantine never reveals anything until it's time to reveal it. He doesn't let people in on his plans or what's going to happen, all this kind of stuff. It's classic John Constantine. But this leads into Swamp Thing number 46, which has the legitimate banner, the Crisis tie-in banner that all Crisis tie-ins have. Well, not all. Ones that are legitimately tied to it have. So that's good. And I mean, I would say these issues are important, I suppose, but they're really not. Like, this stuff could be hand-waved away with like an editor's note or something, someone reiterating the information of how Swamp Thing and John Constantine got into this like part of Crisis. Like, I don't think these need to be included in this overarching tie-in, this, you know, full-on here's all the books to read in what order that we're doing right now. So it sucks that I did the last two issues that way, especially because I didn't talk about the production of either of those issues. Sorry. I just, again, this is the second time I'm recording this, so it's annoying. So on the production side, let's talk about that real quick. Swamp Thing number 44, released October 17th, 1985, with a cover date of January 1986. Authors and creators, written by Alan Moore, penciled by Steve R. Bissett, inked by Ron Randall, inked also by John Tottlebin, lettered by John Costanza, and colored by Tatiana Wood. Swamp Thing number 45 was released November 21st, 1985, with a cover date of February 1986. Authors written by Alan Moore, penciled by Stan Vock, I'm not sure how to say it, inked by Alfred P. Alcala, lettered by John Costanza, and colored by Tatiana Wood. So that's the production. And that is the final issue that we're going to be covering on this episode, but let's talk about next Crisis episode. Next Crisis episode is going to be a little bit different because we have a couple of very big books. So we've got Wonder Woman number 328, normal size comic. But then we also have Wonder Woman number 329, which is the final issue of the pre-crisis Wonder Woman series. It concludes and gets rebooted at number one after the end of Crisis. So this one is like 48 pages, so it's a double-sized issue. And then we also have the Infinity Inc. Annual number one, which is also a double-sized issue. Let me just quickly check if this will load. I believe it is. I looked it up earlier. Yes, it is a double-sized issue with 41 pages. And then we'll be dealing with Infinity Inc. number 21 as well. So only four issues next time, but really it's actually six because of the size of the books that we're covering. It's also a very good sort of cutoff point, because then the episode after that, we're going to be dealing with Crisis on Infinite Earths number 4 and Crisis on Infinite Earths number 5, and then a bunch of All-Star Squadron. But that'll just be a normal five-issue episode. Yeah, and so we're making our way. We're making good progress through Crisis on Infinite Earths. We're finally going to get to the point where I believe every tie-in has the Crisis banner, except for maybe one or two, maybe. So they'll actually have something to do with the Crisis and not just like mention it in passing, which is nice. Because just mentioning it in passing is not a tie-in. It is a cameo at best. Yeah, so thank you for listening. I'm very happy that you did. And I'm sorry that this episode is a week late, because as I mentioned on all of our socials, I had technical difficulties, and basically half of my recording was corrupted and broken bad, and so I had to re-record the second half of it, basically everything after the first crisis issue that we covered was choppy and only half recorded, and so I had to re-record it. So hopefully this one was better, or maybe worse probably, than the original. But as always, please rate and review the show. We've been sitting at 12 ratings or 12 reviews. No, not 12 reviews, 12 ratings. Fewer reviews than that for a while. And I would really, really like to, you know, bump those numbers up, because it helps spread the podcast. I also posted a new trailer for the podcast, because I felt that the old one was a little bit outdated to what the actual purpose and structure of the show is now. So if you want to spread that around, if you're like, oh, hey, you know, maybe you'd like this podcast, shoot that trailer over to a friend or an enemy and see if, you know, that tickles their fancy, and maybe they'll want to download the show and become a fan of the show. But also, we are on social media, if you are not already aware. At Instagram, we're at Issue Podcast. On Twitter, we're at Issue Pod. Threads, issue podcast, obviously, because it's the same as Instagram. And also, when I'm able, I post the episodes to YouTube at issue podcast over there. I need to get back into doing that. It's a little bit difficult because certain episodes are so long that I can't do it easily. I have to do it difficultly. So, but hopefully you enjoyed the episode. And as always, I am your host, Nick Byers, and I'll see you around.